From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with Time magazine film critic Richard Schickel. His more than two decades as a movie reviewer have led him to take a look at the influence of celebrity on society. Also, comic Harry Shearer pays tribute to Las Vegas. Rock and roll critic Ken Tucker reviews Prince's new album, Sign of the Times. And film critic Stephen Schiff takes a look at Prick Up Your Ears, Stephen Frears movie based on the life and murder of gay playwright Joe Orton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. With me is Time magazine film critic Richard Schickel. Schickel has spent most of his working life writing about films. He's written books about Walt Disney and D.W. Griffith. His book Intimate Strangers, The Culture of Celebrity, analyzed the influence of celebrities on our personal lives. Schickel's new book zooms in on one part of the celebrity-making machine. It's a book of color still photographs produced by Hollywood studios to promote their stars and their movies. It features actors and actresses of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. He's written the introduction and the accompanying text. The book is titled Striking Poses. Richard Schickel, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good to be here.
Can you describe the function of the publicity shots that are in your book?
Yeah, it should be said, first of all, that most of them were not made to specifically publicize a given film. I mean, they were made when people were under contract for 7 years to studios. And they were designed in the same way that, I don't know, cigarette advertising is designed today, to keep people aware of certain brand names and keep them before the public by hook or by crook. In most of these cases, I think the pictures are quite funny because they're outrageous pictures. I mean, there was such competition between the studio stills departments, really, to get these pictures into the newspapers around the country that were having color supplements in those days, which began in the late 30s, which is really where the book begins, and doesn't really go into the 60s so much. You were slightly wrong in your introduction. There are a few pictures from the 60s and a few from the 30s. The great age of this kind of publicity still was the 40s and the 50s. When, you know, every newspaper had a sort of Sunday screen and radio section, the movie magazines were in full cry, there were lots of not too elegant picture magazines available in the United States in barbershops and so forth. So that's what these pictures are designed to do, and the pictures are, I think, kind of surreal in their quality because the more outrageous the pose, the more so slightly ridiculous in a way, the more it caught your eye, literally, the more newspapers and magazines would pick it up.
Two of the photos that I really enjoyed as contrasts were of Janet Leigh. One is from 1963 when she's in Bye Bye Birdie, and it's like Janet Leigh, the mother shot. And it's, you know, Janet Leigh on the set with her two children, one's on her knee and the other's sitting alongside of her. Then the other shot's from 1965, and it's at the time she's doing Kid Rodeo. And there she is wearing this black lace teddy with a black garter belt, black stockings, high heels, with a gun belt strapped around her hips.
Giant six-gun, gun belts and garter belts.
Yeah, and her gun's in her hand, and boy, does she look tough in that. It's such an interesting contrast.
Needless to say that there is no point in that movie in which she wears such a getup.
I figured.
It's a straight publicity department composition. There's a third picture of her, too, which is her sort of studio wedding picture with Tony Curtis. And they're kind of, I don't know how to explain it, they're kind of doing a smooch, a big, you know, their lips are sort of bulbously pursed out in order to, and they're looking just adorable and cute, you know, sort of Sandra Dee, early 60s, late 50s, cute. That's the style of that picture. There were all these stylizations that operated, too, in the composition of these pictures. I mean, we have a long section in Striking Poses of just the holiday pictures. You know, I mean, the girl sitting on a pumpkin, the girl with a turkey in the picture, the girl, one of my favorite pictures in the book, the Lane sisters, which only your older listeners will remember, but we're kind of minor movie stars of the late 30s, and they're got up as Christmas presents, and they're sort of seeming to be tucked under this giant Christmas tree. among other things, this is sort of sexist. That's the other thing that I think doing this book was kind of consciousness raising to me, because the pictures you're looking at radically and much more radically objectify the women than the men. I mean, the kind of garter belt.
There's terrific props that are always used.
Lots of faintly salacious, sort of phallic rockets and whatnot when they're posed with them, but also just the sort of cutesy poo-ness of the way they showed women in these pictures. I think they're still funny, but I couldn't help thinking, and I think I may have mentioned it in the introduction, that, you cannot, it is some measure of progress, possibly, that you cannot imagine any stars comparable to these today permitting such pictures to be taken.
How come movies and stars aren't publicized with the same kind of stills, posed stills,
I think for two reasons. First of all, these stars were under long-term contract to the studio. So as I said at the outset, the studios had an interest in kind of cranking out publicity material to keep people reminded between pictures that whoever, Barbara Stanwyck or Charlton Heston or whoever, was a movie star and was about to be out in some new picture. There was that. But the other thing was that the media changed. I mean, in other words, television, and in particular, I would say, the television talk show, in a way, replaced all of these magazines. Mostly they replaced the movie magazines. And so there wasn't the same call for them. Most of the magazines that published this kind of thing, and even the newspapers that published this kind of thing, either went out of business or changed radically. I mean, the star today has a different photographic curse, if you will, and that's the paparazzi picture. I mean, in other words, the star is hated, by and large, hated going to down to the stills department to do these pictures. I mean, partly, particularly in the early days, they had to pour a lot of light onto them. The film was quite slow, so it was very hot and boring work and slightly degrading work in many cases. So they hated doing it. I think stars also hate being frozen. I mean, what they're selling is animation, so the moving pictures and still pictures were psychologically quite different things for them to do. But in return for these importunings to come to the studio stills section, they were really greatly protected. I mean, in other words, it was impossible technologically, let's say in the 40s, for a cameraman to sort of lurk outside a restaurant or outside a resort and with his 200-millimeter lens and try and get a picture of somebody half-naked when they didn't want to be shown half-naked. Now, of course, that's become their curse. I mean, in other words, the studios can't protect them because they're all freelancers. I mean, they have no machinery really to protect them. So if they go out shopping or to a restaurant or something, the chance of somebody lurking in the bushes and grabbing a shot are very much higher. So, I mean, one unhappiness has replaced another unhappiness in their lives in terms of the still camera.
Although the movie studios don't have stars under contract to them anymore because there really aren't movie studios in the way there used to be, there's still plenty of movie stars. How are they marketed differently than they used to be under the studios? You alluded to the
the typical
talk shows, for instance.
Yeah, the typical star today is usually has under fairly long-term contract one of the several large publicity firms that deal in movie stars, and for a percentage of the star's income, they will manage this aspect of the star's career. But generally speaking, that means keeping them away from the press unless they have a film coming out, in which point a campaign is orchestrated, which may include magazine articles, some photography for those. I mean, we do a cover story at Time. Likelihood is that we will caused to have created a set of still pictures that the star will cooperate in making, certainly for a cover image, then they will do a certain amount of, possibly for a high-quality magazine, between pictures may do sit for a profile, but the magazines will want them to key on a film. So their effort is always to a campaign, which may begin some months before a picture is completed, for the picture. They will also do work while the picture is on location, of course. Anyway, they're in the hands of these firms, and they have a great deal more to say with the publicity firm about what they will do and not do than they ever did in the studio days.
Now, I think one of the tricks to modern publicity is that if you're well known and you know that the press wants to talk to you, you only make yourself available when you have something to promote.
I think so. I mean, but of course, there are exceptions. Obviously, there are people who have charities that they're interested in. They have.
But nowadays, it's causes, don't you?
Causes.
Think?
Yeah. now that I'm living in Los Angeles, there's an awful lot of charity. Mm-hmm. That, you know, doesn't make the national press, but there's always a dinner or a luncheon or what have you going on out there that, you know, some stars will be recruited for. And they range, you know, through all the ills of mankind. You can find a star who will help you promote it.
Film critic Richard Schickel is my guest. Do you think celebrities play a different role in American life than they did in, say, the 30s, 40s, or 50s?
Well, I have a feeling that is reflected in Striking Poses, that the celebrity, the movie star in those days, was a much more iconographic figure. And again, the icons, you know, part of the rub that was between them, besides not liking the hot lights in the stills studio, they were always fighting their sense of who they were and the studio's sense of who they were, which were often in opposition. I mean, in other words, Jean Tierney might think of herself quite logically as a sort of upper-crust girl from good schools and a social background in New York, but the studio sort of thought of her, because she had these high cheekbones, as this sort of slow-eyed Eurasian vamp type. So, I mean, the woman in the studio would have been in considerable conflict. I think nowadays there is more emphasis on reality. This is the real person we are now presenting to you, whether in stills or in a magazine interview. There's less of an attempt, because it would be harder to sustain. There's less of an attempt to try and pass someone off as their icon. I mean, in other words, the icon and the reality have to be somewhat more congruent now than they were in the 30s. Because, again, the thing we were talking about before, the protectiveness of the studio. You could insist that Clark Gable was an incredibly sexy male figure, even though there's testimony from his wives that he wasn't so terribly sexy. But you could sustain that image perhaps better in those days. Maybe the tragic case of Rock Hudson would be a good example. I mean, most people in the business knew that he was homosexual from the 50s onward. But at the time that he was a major motion picture star, I think the general public was, in fact, unaware of his homosexuality. I think it had, you know, obviously tragic effects on his life and on his personality. One might even think that he might not have been so driven in a sort of homosexual cruising, if he had been free to be what he was. But there was an element of, I thought, comes out a little bit in the Sarah Davidson book, of self-destructive rebelliousness in that behavior, which, of course, could have led him to AIDS and all the rest of it. I mean, that part is speculation, but I'm pretty sure about the self-destructive rebelliousness. And that was, of course, true of many stars either went all the way into, you know, kind of Frances Farmer self-destruction, or got pretty close to it and pulled back from it in previous times, in the sort of Striking Poses times, if you will.
I want to talk with you more about the effect of celebrities on our culture today, but we have to take a short break. My guest is Time Magazine film critic Richard Schickel. We'll be back in just a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air. Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Time Magazine film critic Richard Schickel is my guest. He's written the text for a book of still photos which were produced by Hollywood studios to promote their stars. The book is titled Striking Poses. I want to continue talking about celebrities. John Lennon was probably the first celebrity assassination. Mm-hmm. And even the Ronald Reagan assassination attempt tied in with movies and celebrity.
Distinctly a celebrity attempt at assassination.
Do you think that stars are getting more paranoid about their fans?
I think a lot of stars are not so terribly concerned about themselves, perhaps. But I think they are concerned about their families. There are more and more... there are firms now that specialize in celebrity protection, and much of their work has to do with protecting the families of the stars. I mean, they're concerned about that. But a man who runs one of these firms, who called me up after Intimate Strangers was published, was really scary to talk to, because he did say that so much of his work deals with truly psychopathic writings and mailings, often of a highly obscene nature, to the stars. He told me that he had stopped several Hinckley-like characters who were on their way to Hollywood and were in the vicinity. I know personally of one such case of a family stalking a star's family. It was a family of people stalking the star's family.
Well, do you have any theories about why there's this, I don't know if it's hatred or what, but why fans want to go out and attack stars?
It's love-hatred, I mean, obviously. Uh-huh.
Jealousy, maybe?
Well, I think there's I think jealousy stops short of psychopathic behavior. I think there's a volatility in people's relationships with movie stars. In other words, there's a sort of love mixed with a sort of envy.
And also this feeling, I think, of it. Well, I'm
it
not good
fall,
enough for
it can
you,
fall,
right?
It can fall over into envy very quickly, the love, especially if the star, in some sense, miscues. I mean, a case that's kind of interesting to me at the moment, and I don't have any firm conclusions about it, is that of Burt Reynolds, who, you know, was a sort of beloved star a few years ago, and suddenly this man cannot make a picture that's successful. It's as if, I don't know, I've speculated that aging, he's now too old to play the good old boy image that he was playing. I speculate that, you know, maybe his feminist consciousness raises the kind of attitude toward women that he expressed could conceivably have backfired against him at this date. I speculated, you know, the rumors that circulated, and which he's had to deny and deny and deny, of him having AIDS. There's no reason to doubt his word on this point. He, you know, was afflicted with a very unpleasant inner ear disease. It's actually quite common. Several of my friends have had it, and it's horrible. And it does cause enormous weight loss. It causes you to look as if you're drunk in public because it affects your balance, all that sort of thing. That may have affected him. I mean, people don't like to think of a star as ill. You know, that illness is supposed to not touch a movie star until great age comes upon them, and then we can mourn their passing with, you know, fatuous television tributes to them. But all of these things have touched him, and this is a career once of enormous magnitude that now is, you know, in what seems to be fairly desperate condition. It's a very volatile relationship. I do think that the typical the relationship of the star to his general public is simply one of these strange, volatile, you know, love, envy things. Now, there is that percentage of the population that is psychopathic, and I suppose I sometimes, in despair, estimate it at 10% of the population. I don't know. Maybe it is. It could be 5%. I think it's a substantial percentage in
some
in a large
cities. It's
country.
Higher than others.
Yeah, and I would say that behavior is not to be compared with ordinary fan behavior. That's really sicko stuff, and you know, the Hinckley thing surfaced a lot of it. But I'm telling you that any star, any that I've ever had become close enough to know anything about with, and that's not very many, but the fact is, you know, they people send them nude photos of themselves endlessly. They send them all kinds of weird things in the mail. It's a real sick thing, and I, in some sense, almost hate to talk about it in public because, you know what, there's always some psycho out there who says, well, that's a good idea. So it really is a, I don't know what to be done about it, but I think more and more stars will protect themselves and should protect themselves. I mean, it'd be crazy not to.
You've written something interesting about journalists who write about celebrities, and you say that journalists are sometimes distrusted and thought of as double agents because they're suspected to be writing about famous people to help themselves become famous. And yeah. since you're in the movie reviewing business, I wonder if you've experienced this kind of distrust firsthand.
No, the distrust that's visited on a movie critic is quite different from the distrust visited on a
People Magazine type journalist.
They have a word for it out there. Interview press. The interview press. I'm not of the interview press, and deliberately so. I mean, I simply do not do profiles.
Yeah, I guess I am of the interview press.
I guess you are, but I mean, it's respectable in public broadcasting, and in Philadelphia is a nice, safe, pleasant city. No one would think of you as threatening, but I think they do feel threatened by a reporter from a major publication like People. It has a gigantic and not very high level reach. No, I was thinking there of the kind of people like Rex Reed in one of his former incarnations. There's usually always a hot celebrity interviewer around at a different level, Oriana Fallaci. These people, I think, are frightening because, you know what? They are career. They are attempting to build a career. They are saying, oh, no, no. And they'll lie. They'll really will say, no, this is off the record, and then it will get on the record. And I mean, I would say that the standards of the interview press, the movie people see, are the lowest in journalism, which doesn't have the highest of all standards to begin with, as witnessed poor Gary Hart's condition last week. But I think this this fear is real. That's the only place it affects me is sometimes unthinkingly, you know, if I run into someone, a director or a movie actor, and they sort of just say press. I mean, I hate being lumped personally with the press, as they say. I know what they mean by the press. They mean these people who intrude upon them and are not necessarily to be trusted. And it's one of the reasons that I, in a funny way, more and more withdraw from contacts of that kind with people. I know sometimes when I'm producing television shows, obviously I have actors who are hosts and I work with them and I enjoy them, you know, but we are in a different professional relationship there.
You grew up in a Midwest suburb.
Mm-hmm.
And you've written that it was popular culture, the books you read, the movies you saw, radio shows you listened mm-hmm. to, that made you restless and made you want to get out of this
I think that's
suburb
true.
That you were in. Do you think that's why people sometimes fear popular culture, because it will make people restless with the lives that they live?
Oh, sure. There's no question in my mind that the rise of popular culture in the United States is one of the things that, you know, really broke up our urban and small town America that kind of persisted into the 20s. And I would say, I mean, again, I don't want to propose that, you know, striking poses as a nostalgia trip, but certainly the imagery that is presented in that book is the imagery very much of my boyhood and young manhood in the Middle West. And one of the things that's to me is interesting about the book is that, you know, at that time it was sort of the existential wallpaper, right? I mean, every time you picked up any publication, you'd see a sort of silly picture of a movie star. And funnily enough, there were so many, there was such a plethora of them that it didn't really register, which is, of course, why the pictures are so outrageous. They were trying to get you to at least stop turning the page. I think that imagery and there's some of it in the book, the imagery of people leading kind of glamorous lives. I mean, for example, one of the things people would do would, the movie studios would go to the star's home and photograph him or her in the home, and it looked beautiful, it looked wonderful, it looked enviable. And these people seemed so enviable. I mean, all the sort of cares airbrushed out of the picture along with the wrinkles. And I think these things, not any one of them, but the steady accretion of this kind of imagery at that time coming over the radio, there were always these kind of and Woody Allen in Radio Days did wonderful things with that. You know, the way the seemingly glittering world just would penetrate your home by the radio, or again by the kind of pictures that are in striking poses. I think it was, in a way, it was very potent, but in a way it was also still a little more distant than the way they penetrate our consciousness via television nowadays.
Film critic Richard Schickel is my guest. We only have a couple of minutes left. I want to ask you a couple of things about current movies. Pauline Kael in her latest book wrote that people used to say, oh, you're so lucky, what a great job, you get to see all the new movies. But now people say to her, oh, poor you, you have to go see all these terrible movies. And a friend of mine is fond of saying that he goes to the movies not because he expects it to be good, but he's interested in the ways in which they're going to be bad. And I wonder if you agree with that kind of pessimistic view of recent films.
I would say for people Pauline's age or my age, and I'm somewhat younger than she is, or even people in their 40s or late 30s, it's hard to go to the movies now because the movies are so consciously aimed at the adolescent culture. There's a kind of an intrinsically distancing effect to these movies if you're older. I mean, it's not really easy to sit through, Project X or The Secret of My Success or that kind of a picture. I mean, movies were always for adolescents, you understand, but they hadn't deliberately cut themselves off from, you know, the older portion of the audience, and vice versa, the older portion of the audience hadn't cut themselves off. I do think that's going to change, by the way. I do think the video cassette is actually going to regroup in a funny way the old mass audience, so that I think more and more movies can be commercially successful with a broader appeal. They don't have to be quite so narrowly targeted to 14-year-olds or 16-year-olds. On the other hand, we've gone through a bad patch, and the bad patch may continue for a while. But I'm seeing actually kind of fewer of this blatantly adolescent-oriented movies.
Well, very quickly, what are a couple of the films that are making you optimistic about the future of films?
Oh, there's a picture, Brian De Palma's new picture, The Untouchables, which I think is a wonderful and possibly even great American work. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm certainly looking forward to Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket because he's a great artist. I think there are a lot of potentially interesting movies over the next few months.
Richard Schickel, I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
My guest has been Time Magazine film critic Richard Schickel, and he's written the text for a new book of promotional still photos of Hollywood stars of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. It's titled Striking Poses. On the next edition of Fresh Air, I'll speak with New York theater impresario Joseph Papp, so I hope you can join us. This is Fresh Air. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, comic Harry Shearer talks about making his pilgrimage to the Mecca of show business, Las Vegas. Also today, our rock and roll critic Ken Tucker says with the new album, Sign of the Times, Prince has gotten back on track. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Prick Up Your Ears, the latest film by Stephen Frears, who made My Beautiful Laundrette. It's about British playwright Joe Orton and his lover, Kenneth Halliwell. And we'll have a news update from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, we have this news. This is Fresh Air. You may have already heard some of Prince's new album, Sign of the Times. Our rock critic, Ken Tucker, says the record is Prince's most successful recent work. Before we hear from Ken, let's listen to an excerpt of the album. This is Slow Love.
Prince's new two-record collection, Sign of the Times, is being hailed in some quarters as this prolific rocker's return to the real world, to the steamy, sexy music that made his reputation in the early 80s. Over the past few years, Prince has had a bad case of psychedelic self-indulgence. He made a movie, Under the Cherry Moon, that as a film disaster is the rock version of Howard the Duck. He released an album called Around the World in a Day that suggested he hadn't even been around the block. With its woozy vocals and hippy-dippy lyrics, it sounded as if this 25-year-old had just discovered Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and it, like, blew his mind, man. Of course, whenever an artist starts doing the stuff that made his initial reputation all over again, critics scramble to pump his hand and welcome him back to reality. Their reality. Much as I detested Prince's recent narcissistic freak-out period, I also tend to think that he's earned his eccentricities. After nearly a decade of record-making, he now possesses a mastery of modern rhythm and blues styles that is unequaled in his generation. Over the course of Sign of the Times, you hear echoes of James Brown, Sly and the Family Stone, Al Green, Stevie Wonder, and Marvin Gaye. But Prince has become the most important black rock star by steadfastly resisting the profoundly racist and profoundly widespread notion that black artists are influenced primarily by other black artists. He's already gone through a deep Beatles period, and thank heavens that's over, but Sign of the Times shows that he's listened carefully and well to white musicians as disparate as Led Zeppelin and Joni Mitchell. The song I'm going to play contains everything I've been talking about: a beautiful pop melody, a sly, stonish vocal, lyrics that suggest Lewis Carroll by way of Professor Irwin Corey. Here's Prince singing a song called Starfish and Coffee.
Miss Kathleen. First was Kevin, then came Lucy. Third in line was me. All of us were ordinary compared to Cynthia Rose. She always stood at the back of the line, a smile beneath her nose. Favorite number was 20, and every single day, if you ask her what you had for breakfast, this is what she'd say. Starfish and coffee, maple syrup and jam, butterscotch clouds and a tangerine, a side on a ham. If you set your mind free, baby, maybe you understand. Starfish and coffee, maple syrup and jam. Cynthia wore the prettiest dress with different color socks. Sometimes I wonder if the mates were in her lunchbox. Me and Lucy often did with Cynthia one around. Lucy cried, almost died. You know what we found.
Starfish and coffee, maple syrup and jam, butterscotch clouds, tangerine, a side order of ham. If you set your mind free, baby, maybe you understand. Starfish and coffee, maple syrup and jam. Oh,
just like the one she draws on every wall, every school. But it's alright, it's for worthy cause. Gone, Cynthia.
keep saying Starfish and Coffee, Maple Syrup and Jam, Butterscotch Clouds, Tangerine, Side on a Ham. If you set your mind free, babe, maybe you understand. Starfish and Coffee, Maple Syrup and Jam.
That was Prince from the new album Sign of the Times. The only thing that's missing from that song is the X-rated romanticism that suffuses much of the rest of the album. I think it's what non-rock fans call erotica. It also works as good rock and roll.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You're listening to Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. That's Gene Pitney performing Viva Schafe Vegas. It's the title song from an upcoming Cinemax comedy special starring Paul Schaefer. Schaefer is known to late-night TV viewers as David Letterman's bandleader. In his first comedy special, Schaefer fulfills a fantasy of headlining with a gaudy act at a Las Vegas nightclub. The show is co-written and directed by Schaefer's buddy, Harry Shearer. Besides directing comedy specials, he's done two others, Shearer writes and performs on radio, TV, and in the movies. He spent 2 years as a cast member on Saturday Night Live, and he co-wrote and co-starred in the heavy metal movie spoof This is Spinal Tap. When I talked with Shearer, he told me that he and his friends have a strange fascination with Vegas.
Paul Schaefer and I and Tom Leopold, these are the two people that I worked on the show with, we started going to Vegas about 3 years ago, not really with this show in mind, but just sort of on what were unconscious scouting expeditions, just going there to sort of steep ourselves in the place because I guess we were at an age where we weren't scared of it anymore or something, or where we had the money to fly in whenever we wanted, something like that. You know, we don't in our show, for example, show, you know, people gambling away their life savings, although there is that element to Vegas, but that's not the Vegas that this show is about. This show is about the show business side of Vegas, what it's like to be an entertainer hanging out there.
Tell me the truth. Does Paul Schaefer really want to be Mr. Entertainment?
Well, I don't know what that means. I mean, Paul does love show business and has a very knowing appreciation for a lot of the artifice of the business, and knowing that it's artifice doesn't make it any less real to him.
Could you sell out? Could you be the kind of performer who plays Vegas?
There are people who can play Vegas who don't have to sell out. Certain musicians. I mean, I don't think, for example, one of the musicians who performs in our show, Sam Butera, who's sort of an old line bop musician. I don't think he's selling out when he's playing Vegas. He's playing the music he loves, and he plays it real well, you know, and he's got a band that's great and great arrangements. And I think that's part of what we wanted to show in Vegas, was that there is more than one aspect of Vegas show business. I think a lot of people think Vegas and think of just the sort of the cliche lounge singer wearing the lame jacket and sort of butchering rock and roll songs for the sake of, you know, middle-aged gamblers from the Midwest. And that's there. As far as myself, I would find it very uncomfortable to play Vegas, only because when I'm doing whatever I do on stage, I sort of want a more attentive audience than one that's thinking about, you know, how much to tip the maitre d' and should we play craps next or go back to the slots.
You seem to have gotten into show business at a really early age. Didn't you work on the Jack Benny radio show when you were a child?
Yeah, and Lux Radio Theater, and I was in Abbott and Costello Go to Mars. Yeah, I was into it from the age of 7.
How'd you get into it?
From the age of 4, I had this piano teacher, and she had a daughter who was a child actress. And possibly as a result of fatigue at trying to teach me piano, she decided to make a career change and to stop being a piano teacher and start being a children's agent, because she had all these contacts from, you know, having her daughter in the business. So when I was 6, she called my parents, and I think she knew that I was really hung up on this stuff. I was an avid radio listener and television watcher, and she called up my parents and she said, I'm going to try to get Harry some work. And they said, great, yeah, fine, uh-huh. And 8 months passed by, and it seemed like just a goofy conversation that had occurred once. And then she called one day and said, I have an audition for Harry for the Jack Benny show. And I went in and got it.
You're writing and performing your own material now on a radio show that you do on the National Public Radio affiliate in Santa Monica, KCRW.
Mm-hmm.
What's your show like? What do you do on it?
Radio is a place where it's very easy to sort of take an idea and get it done in a hurry. And if you're working in the television and movie businesses, that's a very valuable commodity, because ideas grow stale while people have meetings and more meetings and more meetings to discuss whether you're going to be allowed to do them. Basically, it was a way to keep myself writing and interested while waiting for, you know, people to make up their various minds about things. Then after I left Saturday Night Live, I realized that it was also about the only place that I was going to be able to do political humor, because I was not allowed to do it on Saturday Night.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is At Loggerheads. On the right, the Reverend Jerry Falwell. On the left, the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Today's topic, colorizing old movies.
Jesse, there was a time when the secular humanists were content to take God out of the classroom. But today they also want to turn Humphrey Bogart into a pinko. Literally. Without a moral compass to guide us, there is no limit to which the cultural...
Jesse. Jerry, as a gentleman of color, I'm always glad to see the world made safe for pigmentation. Because it's a short line from a color bar to the color bars. And the same people who want to take the red out of a movie scene didn't want to take the lead out of our gasoline. Of course, the wealthy and privileged.
You like to watch a lot of bad TV, I take it?
Yeah.
I find bad TV very comforting. I don't know that I could explain that, but when I'm feeling really troubled, there's nothing that makes me feel better than turning on a really stupid TV show.
Yeah, well, I it's part of my theory that there's nothing worse than good TV.
You want to elaborate on that theory?
Yeah, I just find nothing as boring and sort of pretentious and filled with its own sense of we're doing something good for a change than you know, the shows that are supposed to be good on television. I've never watched an episode of Hill Street Blues all the way through, for example. But I can watch Dark Shadows till the cows come home.
Telethons are always fun.
Telethons are the best, you know. Telethons, when they're real telethons. I mean, the Jerry Lewis telethon is not a real telethon anymore. It's basically a parade of pre-recorded commercials. But a real telethon where people have to ad-lib and keep things going and, what, where, what do we do now? What, where? To me, that's always exciting. I mean, the thrill in years gone by of waiting up to that moment where you knew that Jerry Lewis was going to lose it because it was too much for him. And was going to, I mean, the memories I have of nights when he would just start out and he would start addressing his so-called Vegas friends who weren't coming through and stuff like that. That's a That's wonderful.
Do you ever watch Saturday Night Live, which you used to be on?
Yeah, every once in a while.
Do you ever, this is going to sound like a kind of catty question to ask, but do you ever hope that the show flops? Because I know you didn't left.
Hope that the show flops? I don't think that's necessary. I don't wish, that show particularly well, if that's what you mean.
Why not?
Well, because it was the worst 2 years of my life. But, you know, a lot of the people who made it that way aren't there anymore. It's just, I guess the thing that I feel most strongly about it is that it's real sad to see that. It was sad while I was there, and it's sad when I watch it to see this, what's a pretty remarkable opportunity, get so routinely thrown away. I mean, when I was there, most of the writers I knew there sort of were proud of the fact that they didn't read the paper, you know? Which seems sort of dumb for a live show that had topical pretensions.
You said it was the worst 2 years of your life. What made it so bad?
Well, it's sort of a foxhole situation, you know. All the stakes are real high. People's behavior tends to deterioate in inverse proportion to the amount of money they're being paid. And there's a lot there. When I was there, there was a lot of money around. There was a great lack of ensemble feeling, despite the pretensions. To me, the greatest piece of acting that went on at that show was the end of the show, when everybody would gather together and sort of, you know, sway to the music, and it was like the end of, you know, camp.
I don't mean this to sound like a career goal question, but what would you like to be doing in the near future?
Well, I have movies I want to make, and I'd like to take the stuff that I do on radio and in terms of topical, fairly sharp political stuff, and see if it's possible to do it on television.
Harry Shearer co-wrote and directed Viva Schafe Vegas, starring Paul Schaefer. It premieres this week on Home Box Office. He's also preparing a new weekly public radio series satirizing the ongoing Iran-Contra hearings.
That's you, Schafe, baby.
And this is Fresh Air. Probably the most daring new movie out now is Prick Up Your Ears. It's by the British director Stephen Frears, who made last year's critical success My Beautiful Laundrette. Frears' new film is about gay British playwright Joe Orton, who was murdered by his lover, Kenneth Halliwell. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
Prick Up Your Ears comes across the way Joe Orton's plays did. It's extremely sordid and extremely funny. Its subject is Orton's peculiar romance with Kenneth Halliwell, the aspiring writer who seduced Orton at acting school and then lived with him in a one-room London flat for the rest of their brief lives. When they met, Orton was a semi-literate street bloke. Halliwell initiated him in the ways of literature and lovemaking, pruning and cultivating his protege like a hothouse orchid. But Orton grew rich and celebrated, writing plays like Loot and entertaining Mr. Sloane. And Halliwell found himself languishing in obscurity. He became a drab homebody, the niggling wifey behind the great man. Finally, on August 9th, 1967, Halliwell battered Orton to death with a hammer and then swallowed a fatal handful of Nembutals. Alan Bennett's nimble script doesn't analyze the murder, but it makes the reasons plain. Halliwell adored Orton, but he also envied him. And there was something else as well. It was Orton's wickedly detached humor that goaded Halliwell. It drove him crazy, in much the same way it drove the theatergoers of repressed 60s London crazy. They loved Orton, but they also knew he was laughing at them. Prick Up Your Ears is an inflammable metaphor for a certain kind of marriage, and what sets it aflame is its no-holds-barred depiction of homosexuality. This is gayness in the bad boy style Orton relished, replete with orgies in the public lavatories, mauve-tinted bitching, and even bevies of mutely willing Moroccan boys. Without ever being sexually explicit, Frears has made a revolutionary movie. His camera work is restless and swoony and very distinctive. He likes to whoosh smoothly down hallways. He likes to pace and crane, and his taste for wide, luxurious spaces recalls Vincent Minnelli. He gets a cunning, sexy performance out of Vanessa Redgrave as Orton's formidable agent, Peggy Ramsey.
Mr. Orton, would it be rude to inquire how you're managing to live?
National assistance. £3 ton a week. I'm afraid I've just come out of jail.
Excellent. Papers love all that.
Frears also draws a miraculous performance from Gary Oldman, who played Sid Vicious in Sid and Nancy. As Orton, Oldman has concocted a strutting, heavy-lidded come-on, head lolling back, chest puffed out. It reminds me of a bantamweight Mae West. But Oldman also reveals a younger, less cocky Orton, testing out jokes on Halliwell and pleading for the laugh with a bumpkin's fat grin, as in this scene, in which Orton and Halliwell set up housekeeping.
Neither of us seems to have any family photos.
I'm an orphan.
I always wanted to be an orphan. I could have been if it hadn't have been for my parents.
Oldman delivers a captivating portrayal, and the movie needs it, because Alfred Molina, as Halliwell, is as creepy and off-putting as his real-life counterpart apparently was. Huge, ungainly, and completely bald, Halliwell isn't a man, he's a walking, lurching monument. All of which hurts the movie. It's impossible to understand Orton's devotion to this creature, and it's impossible to slip into Halliwell's point of view, as the movie so often wants us to do. Even so, this is a remarkable film, and at its center is a remarkable performance. With his portrayal of Joe Orton, Gary Oldman confirms what those who have been watching him in British television and theater have long suspected, that this is the most brilliant English actor of his generation.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's what's coming up next time. On our next show, I'll speak with baseball statistician Bill James. He'll explain his love of the game and of numbers and how they come together. Accordionist William Schimmel will try to persuade us that the accordion is good for more than polkas. And critic at large Laurie Stone will review two books that examine mother-daughter relationships. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Joyce Lieberman is the engineer. Chris Bergen directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.